Hi, everyone. My name is Audrey Cooper. I'm the editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle, and thank you for being here and spending your Thursday night with us. As you heard on the video, 4 years ago, we started the San Francisco Homeless Project, which was this crazy idea of getting all the news competitors together to, on a single day, cover the causes and solutions of homelessness. Now it's our fourth year, and each year we try to find new ways of elevating the public dialogue around this crisis and trying to help the most vulnerable among us, those people who don't have a stable place to live at night. And don't mistake me, this is a crisis. 35,000 people in the Bay Area are homeless right now, and that's a low estimate. Are we treating this truly like a crisis? In the last 2 years, according to the only estimates that we have, homelessness in the Bay Area has grown by an astounding 24%. In this county, the total was 31%. And in San Jose specifically, homelessness grew by 42% over 2 years. So I'd like to thank you all for being here tonight. Your attendance shows you're committed, like us, to learning more about this crisis and finding ways to help. I'd also like to thank Cisco, which makes the best cake pops of any company in the Bay Area. Yes, hands up to the cake pops. Without Cisco's support, we wouldn't be able to do this level of reporting or have this discussion tonight. Because of their support, the proceeds from tonight will go to the Chronicle's Season of Sharing Fund, which, in addition to being the nation's largest newspaper nonprofit, is one of the only ones that works to keep people from falling into homelessness to begin with. So let's get into it, right? First up, we're going to speak to a man who's been looking for solutions to homelessness since becoming mayor in 2015. Please join me in welcoming Mayor Sam Liccardo.
Thank you.
Sir.
Thank you, Audrey.
How do you think about the cake pops?
You know, they're fabulous.
Yes. And we already agree on solutions.
Yes. I should also note they're appropriate since today's your birthday.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Be an appropriate time. Yes.
Yeah.
So somebody save one out there and put a candle on.
Yeah, if you want to know what dorky newspaper editors do for their birthday, you're looking at it. All right, so let's start by talking about the latest point in time count, which for anyone who doesn't know, is done every 2 years, and basically volunteers and paid staffers go around and literally count homeless people. It is, we were talking backstage, extremely flawed, but it's useful insofar as it provides some kind of barometer year to year. Of the homeless people in Santa Clara County, 2/3 of them live in your city. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, do you feel like San Jose is disproportionately trying to take on the solution?
Well, let me say this. I think two things can be true. One is we are appropriately responsible for the fact that we have a homelessness crisis in San Jose. And by that, I mean we should be doing much more than other folks because we are the big city and we are the city with the transit, with the services, that inevitably a homeless population is going to critically need and we're going to need in order to help them get off their feet. And so San Jose should be on the hook. On the other hand, this is a regional problem and we know that other cities and towns should be stepping up more as well. And the truth is none of us are doing enough, but I think what we see throughout the Bay Area is that for the most part, there are three large cities that are taking this on as a crisis, as their own. And you know what we saw, I think, through the CASA process, which is, for those who aren't familiar, is a regional process that was convened by Association of Bay Area Governments, Metropolitan Transportation Commission, and others, was that for the most part, there's been a lot of pushback in the suburbs around solutions that force us to share our resources, to enable more people to live in a sustainable way in our communities. And it cannot continue, that is, we cannot solve this problem if it's simply three large cities pushing against the rest.
So, you know, I I wrote down some of the numbers that some of the suburbs were dealing with, and it was, you know, some of them had, like, oh, where is my notes? Milpitas grew at 89%, Sunnyvale at 147%, Mountain View at 46%, Cupertino at 25%. If all of these cities are seeing these jumps, are they just ignoring an obvious crisis that's going to come to their doorstep too?
Well, I don't want to pass.
They're smaller numbers.
Yeah, they're much smaller numbers, so it's hard with a small base to compare percents. I'll get that for you.
Yeah, thanks. It's going well so far.
She's throwing pens at me already. Sorry. I can't believe it. Is this how they do things in San Francisco?
Yes.
So I mean, look, I think we all get the fact that, the homelessness is far more palpable in the parent in San Jose, for all the reasons why it is in Oakland and San Francisco. But we do need both regional and statewide solutions that really encourage everyone to step up, whether that's carrots or sticks or just really hard carrots. We need to really prompt everyone to step up to the responsibility, because we know this is a Bay Area crisis. One thing that I advocate through the CASA process, this was a group, of government leaders and business leaders and nonprofits, was figuring out how we could ensure that those cities that are not stepping up to build extremely low-income housing would essentially have to pay fees. And if they're not going to build the housing in their jurisdictions, then they pay the fee and we use the money to build the housing in their jurisdiction, or they pay a higher fee and we build it in San Jose. But one way or another, we got to get it built. Because one way or another, we need to create stronger incentives for cities to step up to their responsibility. This is a statewide crisis, and there are a few cities and a few counties. You're going to hear from Cindy Chavez shortly, and Santa Clara County certainly stepped up in a huge way. But there are a few cities and counties that are really stepping up, and that's not the way to solve a statewide crisis. It's not equitable, and it's not going to get us to the result we want.
So why do you think we should let those cities pay more to avoid having anything but upper middle class and upper class people live there?
Well, I would say until we can dramatically change state law around home rule and around local control and the authority that individual jurisdictions have to control how their land is used, we're either going to have to provide incentives or, as I mentioned, sticks with very large fines. And if they don't want to build in their jurisdictions, then hit them with a much bigger fine. And, you know, hopefully folks at some point will squirm enough just to build the housing. We'd like to believe that we're all enlightened enough that it won't take that much squirming, but we clearly need that kind of statewide or regional mandate. And so far, no one has taken up that idea in the form of legislation. You can imagine it doesn't play well in the suburbs where a lot of power is, frankly.
Voters, yeah.
Yes, voters. But, you know, we need that. And I think you could incorporate it, for example, in what we call a commercial impact fee, so that those cities, and there have been, you know, cities around us, for example, that have built, let's just say, 3 million square foot spaceship campuses for a company I won't name. And never added a single unit of housing over the 5 years in which that campus was under construction. And if we simply impose a commercial impact fee that said, if you're going to expand corporate campuses in this city, then you're going to have to pay a whole lot more unless you're going to build the housing, and particularly the affordable housing, then I think that will start to align incentives with what we all know is what needs to happen.
Do you think, we talk a lot about how this is a crisis, it's on all of the materials. Do you think we're treating it like a crisis?
No, I don't think we are. I mean, there's certainly people who are doing great work, and there are organizations I know represented in this room that, you know, have people who are passionate about this and doing exactly what we need to address this. But frankly, it's not a crisis for enough of us. And the reality is, this is a crisis that is going to require a lot more resources, public and private. And until we recognize that the cost of doing nothing is far greater than the whatever tax we might pay to address this, we're not going to change.
So let's talk about encampments. San Jose has had some pretty big ones.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of controversy about how the city has cleared some of them or how we've dealt with some of them. The number of people, according to the point in time count, people living in encampments increased by 177% over the last 2 years, and now a third of homeless people in the city live like this. So what is the city's official policy with regard to encampments?
Yeah, this is really controversial in our community, and we've often had very active debates in the city council about this, about whether we should simply sanction some encampments and allow people, perhaps with access to water and basic services, to continue to be encamped in different areas. My own position, and it has been the city's position for some time, has been, look, the cost of providing basic services to encampments, whether that's water and basic utilities and showers and security, among other things, is a lot of resources that are frankly wasted not getting people housed. And as long as we're spinning our wheels, spending resources there, we're not spending resources doing what we know works and what we've seen so far. And just since 2015, with the city and the county and the housing authority, see Catherine Harris here, everybody working together to get more than 7,000 people permanently housed, and 92% of them are staying housed, which is a real solution. Spending a lot of resources on encampments is not going to actually move the needle on really addressing the crisis. Now, that being said, I think we have, to some extent, admitted defeat, and recognizing the magnitude of the crisis is such that we may need to identify some locations where we're simply going to say, look, we're not going to clear these areas, and we'll provide some, you know, basic ability for folks to be able to use restrooms and so forth, and we've asked our staff to go out and identify those sites. Now, here's the great challenge. Find the sites, because I guarantee you, in a city that's largely built out, largely a residential bedroom community for the rest of the valley, there is a neighborhood somewhere that is right next door. And those are very difficult conversations. I'm quite comfortable having the conversation that we're going to build a 200-unit apartment complex for homeless or formerly homeless individuals in or near your neighborhood, but try to explain to a group of parents, oh, we're going to allow an encampment to be there, and people are going to kind of come and go, and you know, we're not really sure what's going to happen, and good luck. You know, it's just not, as a city official, you take responsibility for public safety, for public health in your community, and those aren't easy conversations to have. I'd much rather spend that time talking about where we're going to build permanent housing for those same individuals and actually be able to show people we're actually pushing toward a solution rather than just pushing the problem on you.
But when the city clears an encampment, are there enough places for those people to go?
Reality, no. I mean, are there shelter spaces? Sometimes, yes. The truth is many homeless individuals don't want to go to shelters for lots of reasons. They may have pets. Often the shelters have rules around drug use or alcohol use, whatever it might be. The shelters are often viewed as being unsafe by many homeless people. And let's face it, this is a shelter for a few hours, and that's not much of a solution to somebody who knows and they have to go find a way to get their stuff and go somewhere else when 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning comes along. So, no, there's not enough shelters, but even if there were, I'm not sure that would address the problem, right? The problem is that if folks don't want to go there, the shelters probably aren't going to be the solution.
Do you have plans to build more shelters, and will they look any different? And you know, how do you address all the concerns that homeless people have, which I think many of them are legitimate?
Sure.
Of course, encampments also can be very unsafe places for people too.
Extremely.
Think the last statistic I saw said something like 4 out of 5 women in encampments have been raped there, and it's probably 5 out of 5, and the other ones just don't admit it.
It is a horrific way to live.
So what can you do to build more shelters, or should we even be going that direction?
There's no question there's a place for shelters. You know, we do need low barriers to access places where people can go to be safe for a night. And we're looking now, we're hopeful very soon we'll be able to announce we've got a site to build a navigation center, similar to what San Francisco has pioneered, where we essentially
create.
I'm sorry?
Where's it going to be?
I can't announce that yet, but we'll be sure to tell the Chronicle as soon as we nail it down.
I'll tell you all then.
We have the inconvenience of trying to actually negotiate a good price with the landowner and all that. So anyway, we're getting there, and we're going to be using that statewide HAP money that just came from the most recent authorization from the legislature for that. And the idea is to have a low barriers to entry location where we can have a lot of services, get a lot of beds, 200 to 300, and be able to move people off the street, hopefully being able to move many more of them to permanent housing than what you see nationwide with shelters, where less than 20% of shelter visitors actually get on to permanent housing. And so that's the real challenge. We know there's a need for those intermediate solutions. That's why we're building tiny homes, for example. We know it's really brutally hard for folks, even if they have a voucher, even if they have a job, to be able to find the open apartment for 3 to 6 months. And so we need those temporary solutions. But we have to build those solutions with the end in mind. And the end in mind needs to be permanent housing.
So there's a debate that's happening nationally about a so-called right to shelter and right to shelter ordinances. Where do you come down on that?
I guess I'd say we think roughly 90,000 homeless individuals in a given night in the state of California. The number's probably higher, but we just look at the point in time counts. So a state this size, roughly 900 shelters. Not an easy feat. I don't know how that gets built. And more importantly, the cost to maintain and operate those shelters is so incredibly great. We'd much rather be dedicating those same services to a housing site where we know we're going to have far better outcomes, because you simply are not going to help a meth addict get off meth if they don't know where they're going to sleep from one night to the next, and they're simply moving around from shelter to shelter. So I'm saying I just don't think it's realistic. I don't think we have the billions of dollars to go create that shelter system, and I'd rather dedicate those billions of dollars to the end solution.
But the supporters of that, I think, would say if we don't set these expectations of government, it will continue to fail people too. So is there a middle ground?
If the legislature is ready to authorize the dollars first, that's a great idea. Then I'll be all supportive of it. But, you know, the reality is it's more than just a question of whether or not someone's going to have a place to sleep at night. As we all know, homelessness has a lot of different dimensions. We used to have mental hospitals in the state of California, and Lord knows there were plenty of problems with that. You know, I saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest too. There were plenty of abuses in that system. But we eliminated mental hospitals, and you can't tell me we're doing a very good job with mental health out on the street. We're just not, and it's a failure in every city in this state. And simply building shelters and declaring a right to shelter doesn't address that central issue.
Well, so let's talk about mental health. Something like 42% of homeless people in Santa Clara County say they have an issue with mental health. What can we do to better address those people?
Yeah, and certainly not my area of expertise, because outside of San Francisco, you know, there's a division of labor in the city. We do the building and so forth, and the counties tend to do the mental health. I would like to see Laura's Law adopted here. I'd like to see it adopted in counties throughout the state. I'd like to see what we saw last year with Scott Wiener's legislation that would enable more use of conservatorship. I'd like to see that expanded. And I'd like to be able to do that here. I think the reality we have in the city of San Jose is when someone is having a mental health episode and they're urinating in the middle of the street and screaming at traffic, they are going to be encountered by somebody with a badge and a gun. And that's the wrong encounter, right? That is never going to go well. And although we do a lot of work to ensure our police officers have CIT training and you know, our chief has been really progressive on this and making sure that we are de-escalating. But the reality is, I mean, we had 1 year, we had 6 officer-involved shootings. 5 of the shootings involved individuals with serious mental health issues were having a mental health episode. So it means you need a lot more mental health workers out there, and you need a mechanism for civilians, perhaps with police support, to be able to engage people to get them to treatment where they may not, that may not be their choice or first choice. And I know we take civil liberties very seriously in this state, and we should, as we should in this country, though we don't take it seriously enough in Washington, D.C., I'll be the first to say. But at some point, we have to let go of the rigidity of viewing the well-being of an individual solely through the lens of civil liberties. It seems to me that individual who is screaming at traffic and urinating in the middle of the street is not free simply because we say we're going to let him alone. We've got to find a way that is compassionate and respectful of his well-being as well as the surrounding communities. I'm hoping that as a state, and I'll certainly be pushing for this, see how we can find more middle ground here.
So we're in a tech company. It seems like it's always an elephant in the room when you talk about housing issues, particularly in Santa Clara County. So what, just broadly, how do you think tech has reacted to homelessness in general, but housing as well?
Well, you know, it's been a mixed bag. Certainly we saw great leadership here at Cisco with Chuck Robbins, CEO, announcing a $50 million commitment for homelessness, was I think 2 years ago. And I'm grateful to Chuck for his leadership. We've seen a few companies follow, but not nearly enough. And I think we have to recognize a few things that are true. First, that, you know, this isn't tech's line of work, right? They have a responsibility to the shareholders. That's the way the federal law works, at least. And their shareholders really aren't that interested if their shareholders are throughout the world and 2/3 of their customers are in a different country and half their employees are somewhere else in some other country. They don't feel the intense responsibility to homelessness here. And that is just the reality, right? And fortunately, there are some enlightened leaders like Chuck Robbins that have stepped up, and we'd like to see more. And certainly, I have been prompting and nudging and guilting with all of my Catholic background more to follow.
The people in the spaceship.
Yes. That would be a great start. Yeah. I'd like to believe. Yeah. But fundamentally, we do need tech to step up more. And I should say, it's not just on tech, it's on each of us as elected leaders and as community leaders, because all those campuses that expanded in those cities to the north and west of us, and let's face it, tech has overwhelmingly expanded mostly to the west and north of us in smaller, wealthier communities. They did so in cities that simply were not making demands around, yes, but we need to build housing. And by the way, we need to build affordable housing, because folks who work in your cafeteria are not making what your engineers are making.
When you talk to tech leaders, do you think they get that? Do they understand that they have a role in it? Or are you still hearing what I think a lot of people were hearing 10 years ago or even before, which is like, that's government's problem, or that's not what we're in the business for?
Yeah, some get it, some don't. More get it now than did before. But some are still believe, hey, we just went out with our employees and 800 of us painted a school. It's great, it's nice, but we know we've got a real crisis, and the volunteer efforts like that are helpful for team building, but it's not going to solve a crisis.
And why do you think it's changed? Is it just the pervasiveness of seeing it on the streets where you live, or is there actually a cultural change happening?
You know, I can't speak to it. I mean, with respect to Chuck Robbins and my conversations with him, he was personally motivated. Whether through ethical or religious concerns, he cared because of who he is. And, you know, we all wish we had more leadership like that in the world. I can't speak for all the other folks who have made the decision, but I can't help but believe that if there was more responsibility locally among local government officials to say to tech, if you want to grow here, we need your help, I can't help but believe that wouldn't prod more folks along. That was a lot of negatives in one sentence, but I think you get the idea. I mean, look, the good news is, you know, Google came to San Jose. You know, a lot of talk has been made about their $1 billion commitment and all that, but well before they made that commitment, you know, they signed a memorandum of understanding with us that we approved at council that said they're going to build thousands of units of housing right around their campus. A quarter of those, 25%, will be rent-restricted and affordable. They're going to commit millions, probably tens of millions of dollars of community benefits, and they're going to pay a commercial linkage fee that we haven't even imposed yet, that we hadn't even created yet. They said they'll pay it because they know we need more affordable housing. So there was a certain recognition that there was a need, and we just need to make sure that as these companies want to grow here, they're aware of the need.
So I have more numbers. I know you have a lot of numbers in your head, but one I thought was particularly interesting is that 68% of the homeless people in the last survey said they are homeless because they can't afford rent. Another 60% say they don't have a job or don't make enough, and 47% say there is no housing available for them, which is double the responses from 2 years ago. Mm. And what those numbers make me think is inevitably the boom time that we have been having is going to stop. Are we prepared for what happens in the next recession? Even if it isn't as bad as the last recession, what's going to happen?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I've had meetings with mayors throughout the West Coast, and I mean, this is a disaster all across the West Coast, from Seattle to San Diego. Everybody is talking about the same thing. And several mayors have said out loud, I can't wait for the recession, because at least maybe there'll be some downward pressure on rents, and we might be able to get some people housed. Now, obviously, we know with that comes unemployment. And so I don't know. I mean, I think we're in a brand new world here. We have seen such an incredible surge of job creation, six or seven times the rate of housing construction in the South Bay and in Silicon Valley, that it would take a really significant correction before we can get back into balance. And we're all trying to build more housing, but we can't build at nearly that rate. So I guess what I would say is no, we're not prepared. And I can only hope it'll be better than the good times. Ironically enough.
That seems like the most depressing thing I've heard yet today.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, well, hopefully there's a bar back there next to the cake pops.
The cake pops. We need more cake pops.
Yeah.
The number of people who say that they have a job and are homeless has also increased. And specifically, a lot of those people are living in their cars or in RVs. We've seen that, you know, every media in the world has done a story on the RVs parked alongside tech companies here. Yeah. And to me, it's a uniquely horrifying new trend in homelessness, because you have a home, and they're if you could be so crass, the upper class of a homeless class. How do you think we should approach dealing with the vehicularly housed part of the population?
Yeah, it's so we know a higher percentage of folks who are in cars and RVs tend to be employed than the rest of the homeless population. So one would think this is an opportunity with what we would call lower hanging fruit to actually be able to get folks housed more quickly. And so we are trying solutions along the lines, for example, safe parking. We now have three sites throughout the city. They're city sanctioned, and we have other partners, and we know churches, and Bellarmine College Prep's got a safe parking site. And seeing how we can provide services to those who are utilizing the safe parking sites while they're there with their families, so that we have, at least we know, a point of contact where they're going to be going back to time and time again, and they know they have a place where they can get information and be able to get on the path to be able to identify housing. What we know about, you know, I mentioned tiny homes before, because what we've seen more than anything in this crisis that is so remarkably unusual is that people who have the voucher still can't get the housing, and people who are working, who would be able to pay rent, still can't quite make the down payment. And so being able to provide that transitional housing like we will be, we hope, within a month with tiny homes, I think is going to be a critical strategy for us. Now, we're starting just with two tiny home villages that are in construction now, and I'm hoping we can expand this quickly. But I think it's going to be that housing that lasts the 3 to 6 to 9 months that's going to be really essential to address a lot of the needs of folks that you're describing who are living out of their homes. If we can get folks into at least a stable location for that period of time, what they need is just enough time to be able to get on their feet and find the housing. Obviously, we need just to get a lot more housing built as well. And we're trying everything under the sun. We know that rent-restricted affordable housing is what's most critically needed for today, and we've got 1,000 units that are under construction, another 2,200 units that are in the pipeline, and we're going to just have to try to get that built as quickly as possible. We also need a lot more market-rate housing that can be built, small enough units that might be more accessible to a struggling workforce. And we're piloting something we call co-working right now in downtown, about 700 units in one project, very small units, and we're hoping that...
Co-living.
I'm sorry.
The co-working, you pioneered that already.
Forgive me, co-living. Thank you.
The co-living is really, I mean, I don't know if everybody knows what co-living is, but I find it totally fascinating that people would share like a kitchen
stuff
and a living room and then have a bathroom and a place to go. I always want to know, how do you keep people from stealing your food in the communal kitchen? But I'm told that's not really a problem. But you're building, I think, the biggest one in the world, right?
Or at least in the United States, yeah. And we're going to give a go at this. And we had to change all of our codes to enable it to happen. And the reality is we don't know if it's going to work, but if they're willing to build it, let's try.
When we were talking about this earlier, we were talking about the number that it costs, somewhere around $650,000 per unit to build an affordable unit, which is more than my first house cost in the East Bay. Why does it cost so damn much to build such small places?
Yeah. So, yeah, that would be a typical cost if you're building like a 100-unit apartment and the cost for each one of those apartments. And so it costs a whole lot because the main factors of production, and you know what they are, land is not cheap these days. Labor is expensive in part because we lost a lot of our construction labor workforce in the Great Recession, moved out to the Central Valley and elsewhere, and now we discovered we need a lot of folks to go build stuff. And I don't think the workforce is expanding enough, and we need to do more to help that grow. But the cost of that labor has really gone up because obviously they need to live here too. Combined with that, you know, we're in trade wars with China, and by the way, it would be really nice to have cheap steel. And we had tariffs on Canadian wood, that didn't help. You know, we've got sort of this confluence of factors that's making it brutally hard to get anything built. And I've got a lot of developers that are telling me I'm ready to go. I've got a shovel in the ground if I can just get financing. And they can't get the financing because the numbers don't work. So we've got to find ways to bend the cost curve in a big way. And certainly that's true for market rate housing, but it's also true for affordable housing because we don't have the public resources. I mean, if you just look at the 9,700 homeless people throughout Santa Clara County. If it costs, as we believe, $650,000 a unit, you can do the math, and it's somewhere between $6 or $7 billion we would need if we're going to build all the units for those folks. You know, Cindy Chavez is coming on this panel in just a minute. God love her and all the folks at the county who did a great job leading Measure A. I think that gets us about $750 million for extremely low income housing. Imagine $6 to $7 billion. We just don't have those dollars, and we can't tax ourselves fast enough to get there. So we've got to find solutions that are dramatically lower in cost. And so, you know, we're looking at how can we leverage existing resources more creatively. Right now, for example, we have a homeless challenge with San Jose State students. And so we're talking to a tech company in San Jose State about how we can leverage their platform to be able to find empty rooms in homes throughout San Jose of folks who might be willing to take in a college student for 9 months. Those are really patient people, we hope. and we'll help them out with the rent payment and see if we can fill homes that are frankly too large for the current occupants. Many of you know we've been launching a backyard ADU initiative where we're helping to subsidize the construction of granny flats or backyard units. We're starting a small pilot now, and basically we're providing forgivable loans if the rents are rent restricted on those units. If we're able to prove up this model, we hope we're going to be able to scale that significantly.
Do you think people will agree to do that and to have a rent restricted granny unit?
We're going to find out. We're launching next month when the council votes.
You're taking sign-ups outside.
Yes, yes.
How do people find out more if they were interested in doing that?
Yes, thank you. So the city has a website. We're actually going to be launching a separate website in just a couple weeks where folks will be able to indicate their interest to us. But please go on our planning building website. If you go to sanjoseca.gov and just go to planning building, that'll get you there. But we're going to launch a separate website, and we'll make sure the Chronicle carries a big story about it so folks can learn more. But we did some survey work, and we found out that more than 30% of our homeowners in this city said, if you guys made it, you got the red tape out of the way, you made this easy to finance, this is something I would very seriously consider. And by the way, you mentioned recession. This could be one of those things that helps a lot of struggling homeowners stay in their homes. If they're able to get some additional rent by having a backyard unit. And so we think this may be a solution for a lot of folks at varying levels of income who have a home.
Let's talk about gentrification. There's a lot of, every time I go downtown San Jose, I don't even know what it looks like anymore. It's changing so much. Do you think the gentrification of the city, and particularly the development of downtown and the amount of work that's going on there, is pushing people out and negatively affecting the makeup and the homeless population?
I absolutely think gentrification is happening in San Jose, and it has a long list of negative impacts. It's clearly changing our community in ways that are painful and harmful to families who have been living here for generations. It has a racial dimension that I think is clearly runs against everything we believe about what we want to become as a successful multicultural community. There's no question that displacement is happening through higher rents, for example. I mean, that's obviously the primary driver. I don't think it's happening in a physical way. That is, we're not, there's only one project that we have approved in the last 5 years that actually involved moving anybody from their existing apartments and replacing them, in this case, with 400 more apartments than were there before. For the most part, it is not happening through direct redevelopment. Most of the development in the city is happening on empty lots or pretty close to it. But I would not doubt that if the pressures of the economy were to persist, that is, with continued growth, that would also be something we would have to confront. We've already passed an Ellis Act ordinance, which helps to protect existing residents, and there are other tools as well. And obviously, we need to pay very close attention to that.
One of the things that I hear a lot when I talk to people about homelessness, or I get emails, are these people are coming from everywhere else and they're coming to the Bay Area because we tend to be more liberal and more accepting, and we just need to stop taking in homeless people from everywhere. What do you say to somebody who says that to you? Because I'm sure you hear that all the time too.
Yeah, the data doesn't show that. We do lots of surveys in the encampments and in different ways, typically between 80 and 90% of the folks we survey. And we survey them for lots of reasons. We're trying to identify health issues and how we get them housed and all kinds of things. Hey, do you have relatives in the area? And what we learned is 80 to 90% were last housed in San Jose or immediately around San Jose. So they're ours. And we need to accept responsibility for members of our community. These are our homeless residents. And, I am more than once confronted when I'm in these neighborhood meetings where we're talking about building tiny homes or homeless development in someone's neighborhood. People are talking to me about how the city is threatening to put homeless people in their neighborhood. And I say, look around. I mean, I live in a neighborhood where every day I wake up and I see someone who's homeless living in our park or are on the railroad tracks on my way to work, and you can't tell me homeless aren't already here. Of course they're here. They're already part of our community. So I'm hoping that eventually we are coming to the realization, we recognize that we need to embrace every individual as part of our community.
I don't think that this affects anyone in this room, but when we were speaking earlier this week, we were talking about other measures that might come before voters, and you said something that I've been thinking about a lot, which is that you worry that we're getting to compassion fatigue.
Yeah.
Why do you think that?
Well, what the data says, you know, Measure A passed in 2016 by the skin of his chinny chin chin. Cindy can tell you more about that ordeal. I think they finally figured out it passed about a month and a half after the election day. We put a measure on the ballot in November 2018, got 64%, so it just failed the two-thirds margin. By the way, 64% is a larger share than has ever elected a U.S. president in history, but it's not enough under state rules that require that we get two-thirds to pass a bond to help homeless people.
I don't
people
think you need a majority to elect a president anymore.
Though. Yeah, so that's a good...
That's where you're confused. It's a fact.
Touche. All right.
Compassion.
So we see the numbers, and we've been polling on the same or similar bond measures over the last few months, and the numbers have gone down. What we're likely to do next year is probably looking at a transfer, real estate transfer tax, which has advantages and disadvantages, but let's face it, we need the dollars to address the crisis. But, you know, the compassion fatigue is there because I think in many ways homelessness is affecting people emotionally, and it is affecting the sense of public safety. And we have to be honest about that reality. You know, I met with employers, seven different employers down in central San Jose, heavily industrial part of town, you know, all blue collar jobs. And each one of those owners told me, you know, the blue collar guys who are showing up at work, they're fine, but, you know, I can't actually keep any of the women who are working in the office employed here because they're terrified going to and from their car in the parking lot. And because of what's going on with just the presence of people who have been outside for a long period of time, which obviously affects a lot of people in negative ways psychologically, especially if they're already mental health or drug issues. So we've got to be really honest about the fact that there's a public safety component to this, and the compassion fatigue is going to really accelerate if we're not able to also deal with that reality on the street, which means, yes, we got to do everything we can to get people housed, and yes, we also need to be sensitive to the reality that those public safety concerns are real. I mean, you know, the constant complaints about, you know, the guys throwing the rocks through the window and threatening people with the crowbar and that kind of thing. It's just the reality.
All right, so we have time for one last question, and I like it to be a little more upbeat.
Uplifting.
So,
God, I'm depressing the heck out of
everybody. No, it's good. So tell me at least one thing that you want everybody in this audience to do and one thing that gives you hope.
Wow, okay, great.
That's two questions. But.
Yeah, that's two questions. First, let me start with what I'd like everyone to do. I know I'm already looking at some familiar faces of people who are Yul Stirner and others who are doing incredible things out there. And thank you for what you're doing. Chris Richardson, so many others. If you are not doing something today that is committing you in significant ways, in time, treasure, talent, to addressing the homeless crisis, I am hoping that you will find whatever that is that engages you and makes you passionate and talk to one of these folks or talk to us. And we would love to find a way to get you engaged in helping to tackle this crisis. This is the challenge of our generation. This is the ethical challenge of our generation. And two decades from now, our children, grandchildren will be asking us, what did we do about this challenge? And if we don't have a good answer for them, I don't think either they or we will judge ourselves very well. So I think it's on each one of us. With regard to What gives me hope, I'll tell you one thing that gives me hope. There are lots of things that give me hope, but we launched an employment program that with a couple of partners, Downtown Streets Team and Goodwill, last year to get a few dozen homeless individuals working, cleaning up our streets, cleaning up public spaces, and then they would benefit from job training through Downtown Streets Team and placement and so forth at Goodwill. And we have seen incredible success already. And I was just talking to one of the managers of the teams over at Goodwill, who talked about how six people have already, on his particular crew, had already gotten full-time jobs, and talked about one gentleman, his name was Luis, who said it absolutely transformed him, that it was just the fact that someone thought he could be useful in a community was what inspired him to be clean and sober, to be working now full-time on a Caltrans screw, and now he's made contact again with his daughter and he's rebuilding his life. And I thought that was incredibly inspiring to me, that just the ability to create a path for someone to believe that they could be part of our community again. You know, we live in a time of such deep isolation and alienation. And of course, the events of the last 2 weeks demonstrated in spades, you know, how a 19-year-old goes and gets a semi-automatic rifle, and get on another subject. But it seems to me that the most despairing dimension of homelessness is the fact that people feel so completely alienated from other human beings. And to the extent that we can help folks believe that they're once again part of the community, that, it seems to me, can be an incredible catalyst for change. So this program has been just started. We're now going to expand it to 100 individuals in the next couple of weeks. Right, Chris? Yeah, we're going to get there. Yeah,
we
we're going
to
get there.
You just committed to 200.
You guys aren't taking them all. Don't worry. We're going to get 100 folks employed, and hopefully we're going to see the impacts just grow.
Awesome. That's a good one to end on.
Thank you, Artie.
Thank you very much for coming. And now we have a video for you all about the work that Destination Home is doing in Silicon Valley, after which we'll have the second part of our evening with Chronicle reporter Kevin Fagan. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Erin.
I was running a plumbing business. It was great. We prospered and things were well. And then I got hurt and the spiral began.
Every night across America, 500,000 people go to sleep homeless.
When you're in the street, you are invisible. You're out there. Nobody sees you.
You have to make hard choices, really hard choices.
As unimaginable as that is, even more are at risk of becoming homeless.
There are homeless from every profession. Plumbers, electricians, doctors, financiers, a quantum physicist.
Which is why we're committed to help put a roof over the heads of those who need one most. And for those at risk, helping them keep theirs.
With all the homeless people out there, we were chosen for an apartment. It's better than the lottery. This is a place to live.
Together, let's be the bridge to a place called home.
I don't know you, but I love you for what you've done and how you helped me.
Okay. Lowe. I'm Kevin Fagan at The Chronicle, as I'm sure Audrey said, and these are my panelists, which some of you may recognize. I'm a reporter at The Chronicle. I've covered homelessness for decades, slept in the street for 6 months years ago to do a series that then launched me into a national beat on homelessness. And along the way, I've talked to some of these folks and found them to be wonderfully knowledgeable and wonderful people, which is why they're on my panel. What we have is we have Jennifer Loving on the far end.
Hey, everybody.
I figured you would know her. I call her a force of nature, advocating for and working in homeless shelter, housing, and policy programs for more than 20 years. She is, of course, CEO of Destination Home, which you probably know is a public-private partnership working to end homelessness in Santa Clara County. She has shepherded programs that housed thousands of homeless families and chronically homeless men and women, helped get the landmark 2016 Measure A bond passed, which generated nearly $1 billion for affordable and supportive housing in the county, and last year managed to be cool enough as CEO for Cisco to give $50 million to Destination Home to fight homelessness. There. That's all the blatant bragging we'll do
enough
tonight.
For that. Yes.
I know, she looks so embarrassed.
Talk about Claudine.
Awesome.
And next to her is Claudine Sapilli, who works, yes, an awesome human being who works at the nonprofit City Team program serving impoverished and homeless people in Santa Clara County in the Bay Area, and she specializes in helping them with employment. She's an honorably discharged Navy and Army veteran, which is kind of a rare combination. Yes. And having experienced homelessness herself in the mid-2000s, she intimately knows the challenges of anyone in the streets and the joys of helping people overcome those challenges. And then we have Cindy. Yes. And then we have Cindy Chavez, who I'm sure you know. Cindy's, of course, a Santa Clara County supervisor who has fiercely championed the causes of impoverished and homeless people for more than two decades. She spearheaded pioneering health insurance for Santa Clara County children that became a national model, helped this year to create San Jose's first LGBT homeless shelter, and was the primary architect of that nearly $1 billion Measure A bond. She continuously pushes for more housing for low-income and homeless people all over the county.
Thank you.
I have the feeling you guys knew them already, so I'm glad we're among friends. We're going to have a little talk about some of the issues. In San Francisco, of course, I specialize most in San Francisco's homelessness, but I've done homeless coverage all over the country. And, of course, here, the thing that interests me here is you have more land, you have double the population and about the same number of homeless people, but it's still the same kind of problem. You still have the same challenges, the same solutions that need to be done. And these folks are masters at shepherding people toward that. So what I'd like to talk about first is the fact that there are different types of homeless people. It's not just the guy sitting on the street shooting up in his neck under a blanket. It's a whole strata of different kinds of people experiencing this crisis. You have the chronically homeless people, you have people in the middle who are in shelters for quite some time, and then you have people who bounce through and self-resolve, as they say. Jen, you've had a lot of experience. Talk to me about what people don't know about different kinds of homeless people.
So, hey everybody. So first, I want to say that video was about Second Street Studios, which is, right? Which is the city of San Jose's first 100% supportive housing project. And the fact that it's first is awesome and terrible, right? So that's part of the problem of why we have so many people that are outside. But that's about Second Street. That was awesome. So the second thing I want to say before I answer your question is, how many people here are doing the work or have lived expertise with the work? A lot of us, right? Yeah. So I think there's a ton of expertise in this room, not just, right? I know, I see you. So to answer your question, I think... You know, we can talk about subpopulations of who encounters homelessness, right? And talk about veterans, or you can talk about families. But what's really, I think, important to talk about is disproportionality. You know, homelessness is part of, you know, this racist system that we have, whether it's equity, housing equity, or access to jobs, or education, or income inequality, or what, right? So what we really have is a disproportionate amount of people of color who enter into homelessness, sometimes as high as 8-1, 7-1. And so I think that's something that we don't always equate. For some reason, when it comes to homelessness, we want to figure out what the person did to do something wrong. When we don't look at how structurally unfair this country is and how we do not all have the same opportunities. So that's how I think about it.
Well, yeah. And so what that does is it means there people experience homelessness with different sets of needs. Supportive housing, for one. Supportive housing is crucial for chronically homeless people in particular. Not everyone needs supportive housing. Mm-hmm. That's housing where you have a complex or have a series of units, and then you surround people with counseling. Some people just don't need. Some people have the homeless prevention program that you run, where they can get caught before they even pitch in. But Cindy, you've done a lot of advocacy for supportive housing. Tell me, why did it take so long for supportive housing to catch on here? And what are you doing
Why
to get
are you
it
giggling
going?
About that?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I want to just say how excited I am so many people are here to think about this and to, you know, because we got to get to the next generation of solutions. And just to be frank, like, we don't have a magic bullet. Like, we've got some great things that we're doing, but we've got much more that needs to be done. What I would say is that I think that it really does have a lot to do with equity, which is that as a society and a community, we don't invest in the needs of the poor. And if you think about it, if you make minimum wage in this state, you know, what are you making a year? You are extremely low income if you are full time and make minimum wage. And so in many respects, we don't have the wages people need. We don't create opportunities. And, you know, in this nation, we actually used early on, in our early HUD days, we used public dollars to build middle-income housing, not extremely low-income housing. And just to make one other point, you know, a housing unit costs about $600,000 to build. If we're building an extremely low-income housing, that means that there's much less rent and much less, it's the ability to pay it back is harder. So what it means is that we have to really fundamentally decide that we're going to prioritize the highest need people. And there's actually a really interesting point that I'll just say that at the county that we learned is that we were spending and still do approximately $520 million a year on people who are homeless. Mm-hmm. In services, medical, jails, mental health services. So thinking about how we change the dynamic so that we're doing what is fundamentally economically right, right for human beings, and right long term means that we need to shift spending money on, you know, really frankly, keeping someone homeless and relatively healthy as they visit our hospitals, and really then maybe just sheltering them. I mean, it's kind of crazy if you think about $500 million a year. That's nuts. We should absolutely change the way we do that. And that's why I think it took so long.
Yeah, well, and then one of the sets of figures that I always like is that it costs about $85,000 a year to leave someone in the street with hospital calls, ambulance calls, police calls, but about $20,000 to $25,000 a year to put them in supportive housing. You know, the math works out. It's fuzzy money. People say, wow, if you save that money, where's the cash? It all washes out, and it's the right thing to do. That's what cities across the country have realized over the last 20 years, and it's nice to see Santa Clara County catching up on it. Hey, tell me a little bit about the progress in building this, because you're about 30% toward your goal of Measure A.
So here's the good news.
Let me
just say that this actually relates to a very specific person. So a person that I worked with in the community for a really long time became homeless. And one thing I just want to comment is it can happen to anybody. Like we all know someone that's on the edge. It literally can happen to anybody. But we moved this person into permanent supportive housing, and I was so excited for him, and I walked up to give him a hug, and he said, I mean, he was shaking, and he said, it's terrible out there. You have to do more, and you have to do it faster. Mm-hmm. And I thought, first of all, I thought, what a great advocate, right? He had his, but that was not enough, so he was going to make sure I moved on it. But so here's what we did. We put the ballot measure together, and I have to just say how much I appreciated the leadership of Jennifer Loving and a number of you in this room, and I see you, Catherine, and others who've been advocates for this for such a long time. The ballot measure had $700 million set aside for extremely low income, mm-hmm. and of the whole nut, it's $950 million, we are ahead of schedule. So what we decided, and it was very random, we were going to spend all the money in 10 years. And the developers told us that was too fast, and the homeless advocates told me it was too slow, so we knew it was just right. No, I'm just kidding, it's not just right. But we have drawn down our first tranche, and we are ahead of schedule. So we have 19 projects in process. We have many, many more in the pipeline. We're building in 6 cities, mm-hmm. and we're ready to go get our second tranche of funding.
And it's just, yeah. It's the kind of, it's, talk to me, Linton Chen.
Well, think about what she just said. Silicon Valley has the highest land prices anywhere. We're building housing now for the poorest folks. Everyone said to you, it couldn't be done.
Yes.
19 projects later, ahead of schedule. By the government.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but okay, thank you there. But Santa Clara County, in partnership with other great cities, and I know we have a number of the nonprofit developers here, and give them a round of applause, because it's the hardest stuff to build, and they do it. So I see you, Mr. David Neal.
What's very important is a surge like what you're doing here. I've seen and reported that in Salt Lake, in Houston, in Denver, in parts of New York. The surge can create this housing quickly, and then the trick is to keep it sustained, mm-hmm. and to keep the funding sustained and keep the services going.
We've mm-hmm. learned from those mistakes. So what I love about Measure A being part of the county is that the county is saying we have to pay for the services for these units.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what we want, because we want the county on the hook, because they provide that medical services and the health services already, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and is that, how's it, Catherine Haraz here?
Yes.
So Housing Authority Director, the Housing Authority is shifting their vouchers to use project-based vouchers, so there's money for these projects to run over time. Yeah. Like, without that, these projects wouldn't work. So it's the willingness, really, of these governmental entities to sit together and pool money. The mayor was talking about what the city is doing, and I don't know if he talked about the fact that they allocated 45% of all of their housing dollars for extremely low-income housing at the city of San Jose. But that's something. What the county is doing, what the housing authority is doing, all of that together is how you get it done.
Yeah, and then sustaining it, and also providing the services. Claudine, what do people who come into nonprofit that you work at, City Team, which does wonderful work with employment, what do people need most when they come in?
Yeah, well, first, before I get there, I just want to say that when I grow up, I want to be just like them. Yeah. So we see many faces of homelessness, going back to your original question. So a lot of the people that we see living in our homeless shelters or coming in and out of the homeless shelters, if there's vacancies in the homeless shelters, they have jobs. I mean, these people, if you were to walk by them on the street or seen them in Safeway or something like that, you wouldn't know that they were homeless. They smell good because they have cologne on, you know? And so these men that we're working with in our Men's Bridge program that is housed in our homeless shelter, I mean, they make minimum wage, $15 an hour, or they're making $17 an hour and they just can't make that mark. They can't reach the threshold that would help them afford an apartment, let alone a room to share. I mean, have any of you looked into renting a room or getting a roommate or something like that? I mean, a one bedroom that you share a bathroom, you pay $1,100 or $1,200. I mean, that's insane, right? So our approach is that just like Cindy said just a moment ago, the economic is at the core of this, right? Mm. At the core of the homelessness crisis. And so everything that we do at City Team and our Learning and Career Centers, that's where we focus on. We focus on employability of people, increasing their employability. And obviously, some people that are coming off the street that have been unsheltered for so long, they're gonna have skills gaps. Mm-hmm. How do you expect somebody to get into a living wage earning job when they don't have the skills to get into that job, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why education and training is so important to us. We see it as one of the keys to success, right? And our homeless shelters, we have one in Oakland and one in San Francisco and one in San Jose. Our homeless shelters are transitional housing programs, and then added to that are our residential men's and women's programs. We focus on providing not just a shelter over their head, because just as you heard the mayor earlier, just having a roof over somebody's head is not enough. They need services, and they need services that are targeted and services that are intentional and services that they really need, right? So people say services, somebody might say case management, but what really does that even mean, right? So are you managing a case, a mental case? Or what kind of case are you managing, right? So what we do is we do it from an individualized approach. We figure out what are the barriers that this person, what barriers are they encountering that is preventing them from getting into a living wage earning job, number one, right? That is preventing them from being able to either rent a room or get into a studio or get into something like even an SLE, right? A sober living environment or an SRO, a single room occupancy sort of living, right? So those are the things we focus in on. Mm-hmm. And we start tackling those things. And a lot of what we have found, two highest on our list, number one, criminal background, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I have been incarcerated in my life. I've broken a lot of laws. I've run from the police, and I loved doing it. I stood in a courtroom. I stood up in a courtroom about 2005, 2006 was when I was in the thick of things. And I literally said the really two bad words. And you know what those two bad words are, right?
You
starts with
so
an F, right? And I was not in any mental capacity I didn't understand yet. And I felt like I had the world against me, or I was against the world, kind of like something Tupac said, right? So mm-hmm. I feel like in order for us to really tackle this problem, we have to tackle it from the economic perspective, right? Sir, what do you do for a living? You know, and it's like, and one of those things is like, what do you do for a living? And it's like when somebody responds and says, I'm a software engineer, a software developer, automatically in your brain you think, wow, they must have graduated with this degree and that degree and the other thing. People coming into our homeless shelters, some of them don't even have a high school diploma. Yeah. How can I get somebody into a living wage earning job if they don't even have the basic degree that you get when you graduate high school? It's impossible.
You know what I'm hearing here is I started covering homelessness when about the time Reagan got elected. So I watched the evolution of homelessness. That's when the federal government gave up 70 to 80% of its responsibility for creating social programs and housing. It was a disaster. All through the 80s, guys like me were very busy covering this. The evolution of the attention to homelessness since then has resulted in what was happening here. The surge in housing, that's fairly new, to put this much money into housing. And it's the blossoming of a realization that's taken 30 years to come around to. And providing support services, that has also evolved so that now there isn't any question that you have to provide support services for people. And then creating the kind of wraparound full service stuff that Jen does with her organization is if everyone moves forward in this way, it can address homelessness. And some cities are able, some communities are able to actually statistically end homelessness, but you have to keep ahead of it. Because Salt Lake City fell behind. Houston has slipped a tiny bit. It's not like you create all this stuff and you're done. Mm-hmm. It's you have to keep moving forward on it. Now, one of the we're going to take questions in a little bit, but one of the things I wanted to hear about is the idea of a right to shelter. That's the idea that's coming out right now out of Sacramento. I know you have some very strong thoughts about that. People need talk to me about how shelter can work. Yeah, we're looking at you. Jen, what do you think?
So this is really important because it's, you know, people suffering outside is the worst, right? Having more interim temporary options for people is important. Using some sort of legislation like New York is doing to make people go somewhere so people who have a home don't have to look at homelessness is not right. Homelessness in New York, there are people that live 30 years in the shelter system. I know people who have been raped, who've been assaulted, who have been, not that that doesn't happen in the streets too, I know it does, but I'm saying promoting this as some great thing when it really, to me, is a political answer for all the complaints that people who are not homeless make all the time.
It puts it out of sight. And, that's the idea.
And if there was enough money for everything, which I think you talked, I heard Sam talk for an hour that there isn't money for everything, right? When it costs this much to actually solve homelessness, we need to have, I think, a measured approach. And I think, again, Santa Clara County has more than doubled its shelter capacity over the last few years while doing these 19 Measure A projects. People need to have a place to go, but making this a primary solution does not feel like it's about the people that need the solution.
Yeah, in New York, people, there's a law saying you either take jail or you take a shelter. And so they conveniently built the shelters out of the city center. So I don't know how many of you have been to Manhattan recently, but gee, it looks like there are no homeless people. They're living in what has de facto become housing projects. They're not housing projects. They're just shelters that are rotting away. Claudine, what is the first thing you need when you come in? What is the, in your experience, what is the first thing you need to come out of the shelter into housing?
Out of the shelter into housing. I really feel...
Because I just wanted to make the point that I think everyone here agrees that the goal is to make shelter a short experience. Mm-hmm. You're going in a shelter, then you're going off to the housing.
I think having a support system is very important. I'll elaborate a little bit on that. Because when you're homeless, has anybody in here been homeless on the street, in and out of shelters, living in your car? When you are in that space, you kind of... Like, you don't mean to wake up in the morning and go, I'm going to be homeless today. No, that does not happen, right? But when you find yourself in it, then you figure out, holy crap, this is becoming more and more permanent by the day. And here's the thing that you start experiencing. You feel like you're in quicksand, right? Mm-hmm. So quicksand is just normal sand. It's not just some unique type of soil, right? So quicksand is just normal sand that is so saturated with water that when you find yourself in it, you try to move, it cannot support any weight. The more you move, the more you sink, yeah. Right? And that's what I experienced when I was in homelessness. It was like everything I tried to make, every move I tried to make, I felt like I was sinking lower and lower and lower. And nobody sees you. Nobody sees you. And then you start thinking that you, when you're around normal humans that are housed, you get a sense of that the people that have homes that are around you are so very annoyed by your very presence, right? And then you just get to a point where you just start thinking, you know what? I've had such a bad day, I don't give a damn what those people think, right? And that's when, if you're out and about in the streets of San Francisco or down here in San Jose, and somebody acts out, that's probably the kind of day they are having. They are up to here, and they finally get to a place where they say, I don't care what anybody thinks of me, right? So I completely forgot what the question was about.
That's okay. I like that riff, because that gets...
support system. Thank you, dear. Thank you. I appreciate you. So having a support system. So when you're in that quicksand, you need something to grab a hold of that is stationary, that is there, right? That's not going to move itself. So then you can start to make these movements up and eventually lift yourself up out of this like whirlpool that keeps pushing you down. So those things that you can grab a hold of, that can be an agency, right? Like City Teen. That could be a case manager. That could be that can be an AA sponsor, a spiritual mentor, somebody from church. Or, you know, one of the things that really mattered to me when I was going through it was when people looked me in the eye and acknowledged my presence. Because there's a weird thing that happens when you get that, when somebody looks you in the eye. It's almost like this unspoken validation, this unspoken acknowledgement from this person to that person that I see you and you matter and you're valuable and you're worthy, right? That is, I mean, we pass by people, I'm sure, every day on the street or they're laying on the street and you just walk by and, you know, not even look them in the eye because you're afraid of what they might see in you or of what you might see in them. Right. So that support system and all those things. So that's what we become at City Team in our learning and career centers is we become one of those stationary things that somebody could grab onto to help themselves up out of the muck, the mire that they're in. Right.
And that's yeah. That's one thing to never forget. I don't think anyone was a child and said, I want to be homeless when I grow up. No one wants to be homeless. I mean, you can have an adventure for a while, and then it goes bad. But deep inside, at 3 in the morning, when you're sitting in a camp or you're sitting on the sidewalk with someone, there is that spark in there that you can see. There's always a person worth saving, and there's always hope to bring someone out of that experience. Look at Claudine. I mean, it's look at a lot of people. You can always come out of it. We should take some questions because it's about that time. Okay, I think Sarah's around with a microphone. Let's have this lady right in the middle here, if you don't mind. You got a mic, or are we just going to do it busker style? All right, shout it out.
Yeah. But I think the problem in this country is we don't have the support system and the family member to bring you out. And some of it is we have someone in our family. As soon as they turn 18, the doctors, the people, the school, everyone says, oh, he's adult. We can't give you any information. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to help this. And the other thing is you said you need to look at them in the eye. I actually volunteer at shelter centers, and I did look at our person, and that person got really violent against my 12-year-old and me, and we were so scared, and I really want to help, and I would appreciate if you guys can write some, you know, suggestions that we can help. That would be great.
That is tough, because people can be, when they're in crisis like that, they can be troubling. Cindy, we were just talking about family support.
So just a couple things I wanted to mention. So the County of Santa Clara many years ago created what's called a reentry center. Mm-hmm. And we were actually one of the first, I think, in the country that did this. And it's an opportunity for people when they come out of jail to be able to get connected to mental health services and good, fabulous leaders like Claudine doing training and a bunch of different kinds of services. And one of the things that we found is exactly because of the point you raised that we end up with a lot of young adults in custody who have mental health issues. And their parents want to help, and they may not even know that we have their child in custody. And so one of the programs that we're just kicking off is a family finding program so that we can support efforts for reunification. And really, this came from two people who were formerly in custody, who are part of a working committee, the reentry committee, gave us this idea, and so we're just beginning that. And then the second thing, for those of you who don't know, the NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, also has a contract with the county. So if we have somebody who's mentally ill in custody and their parents are looking to figure out how they can help, then what we do is connect them to NAMI so that NAMI can help them communicate with us. But you are 100% right. We can do so much more as it relates to really helping to bridge those relationships.
And that also helps for older people, too. older people who age out of their jobs. That's a growing homeless crisis as well. Mm-hmm. Helping the families help their relatives. Mm-hmm. That can be really key. Jen, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
There's another way that we really need everybody's help that's also, it's free, is as these Measure A projects or affordable housing complexes are coming online, there are rooms that have three times this many people that want to say no to them. And they get very angry, and there's a lot of fear and fighting and yelling. And if, you know, 19 projects, but we want to do 120, so long way to go. And every time you hear about an affordable housing complex being built near where you live or near where your faith congregation is or near where you work, if you could support it, if you could learn more about it, make a choice, but support it, meaning write a letter to your council member, send an email, go to a meeting and say, I'm okay with affordable housing in our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. There are a number of projects throughout San Jose right now that are in various stages and in other parts of the county. We have a table, Housing Ready Communities is this place where you can sign up and we'll send you alerts and we'll say, hey, this project is coming. If you live around here, we could use your help. So it's free, and man, we need your help.
That is always a challenge. Claudine, you had a thought on this.
Yeah, just very quickly, the young lady had said something about being able to help, right? Where can she help? I think one of the things, one of the very very profound things I did, not last week, but the week before, Destination Home was able to send me to Washington, D.C. for a National Alliance to End Homelessness conference. And one of the things that I did while I was there was I actually stepped out of my comfort zone and joined a delegation to go up to Capitol Hill. I mean, when I think Capitol Hill, I think Trump, and I just think I don't want to have anything to do with that, you know? So I stepped in, I went along with Home First. I don't know if any of you have heard of them. Yes. So I went along with this group that went into Senator Feinstein's office, right? And we were all there, Riverside County, LA County, Orange County, and me from Santa Clara County. We were all there to speak up about what's going on, right? To advocate for the people that could not be in Senator Feinstein's office that day, right? People I work for, we serve at City Team. So one of the things that I did was, even in my shaky voice, I mean, I actually spoke up about 68-year-old African-American Vietnam War veteran that we still are having so much trouble housing with the veterans HUDVASH, and we're having so much troubles with it, right? And so I did that. I came back to San Jose. I told her about it, told Jen about it. And it really just gave me this, it's one thing to work hand in hand with people that are homeless. It's completely something else to start effecting change from the top down, right? Because we can work in a homeless shelter cafeteria and serve meals and serve drinks to the homeless. But if nothing changes from up here, nothing really truly changes down here. Do you see what I mean? So from the young lady, so if you want something else to do, right, go on the NAEH website. You could go on there and send a letter that, with your own words, send it out to Feinstein, to Kamala Harris, you know, to Pelosi. I forget the last name of the lady named Zoe. Yeah, so send it to, and you literally, I did that last night, you know, in preparation for this. I needed to get in the zone because I was so nervous. So I received a message from Zoe's office. I mean, I was amazed. I was so amazed that I did. So whatever you can do to advocate, whether it's attending one of the events that Jen was talking about, when you find yourselves in conversations with people that say, not in my backyard, you speak up for what you believe in. And I'm going to tell you what you believe in if you don't already know. Okay? You believe in the fact that every human needs hope, right? Those were words from Kevin Fagan over here. So the other thing that you believe in is that every human needs a home, right? It's very simple. I've seen it since we've been in here. I've seen it says the solution is simple. Put people in homes, right? That is what you believe in, and that's what you're going to write your senator or your representative about. It's pretty simple.
And yes. And the noise... It's the noise and the pressure that does make a difference. I know Dianne Feinstein, I've known her many years. She started the first shelters in San Francisco, and the original idea was a sandwich and a cot. Well, she learned very quickly that didn't work. And even as early as the late 80s and the early 90s, we had what were essentially navigation centers, which have been reinvented of late and given a new name, and it's a great technique. But pushing that kind of thing, Jackie Speer slept in a shelter a few years ago. A lot of the leaders in this area, in our area, really do get it. They need the noise, they need the voices, they need the letters to propel things forward, because mm-hmm. it's they can't do it in a vacuum.
And they need to make room for people who have lived expertise on this issue.
Yes.
Right? And
we got another question here.
Hi. I have a question. I'm a new transplant from the East Coast. I'm now retired, and I grew up in a high-tech industry throughout my life, and I saw systematically as the decades went on. I spent a lot of years with that company. More and more of the jobs connected to my company, the assembly of our products, moved overseas. The comment about someone without a high school education, there's two existential crises in this country right now. We all know what they are, and this is ground zero: economic inequality and the climate crisis. In terms of economic inequality, what I'd like to see the leaders of this community, including the mayor, who mentioned, for example, Cisco has engineers and it has the people that work in their buildings and clean the buildings and make their food. But there's a third category of workers Cisco has, and we all know who they are. They're overseas, they're down in Mexico, working in jobs that used to be the jobs that we had here in the United States, the manufacturing base. Yeah. I would love to see this innovative area that you and I all live in. It's nice that we have solar on our roof. It's nice that we drive electric. I'd like us to see us do something in addition to, besides climate change, confront the existential story, which is economic inequality.
I know
Ro Khanna sponsored a wonderful bill to help the people in Appalachia train for new jobs. He needs to have a sit down with the leaders of Cisco, LinkedIn, Microsoft, all the people in this community, and ask them, what factories can you bring back to the United States so that person making $15 an hour can maybe make $18 an hour? Otherwise, people who don't graduate from high school or graduate poorly or just don't have the motivation to go to college are going to fall further and further and behind, and they're going to be on the streets. So I would challenge this community to challenge the high-tech industry to bring more jobs back to the United States to help fill the gaps in the growing economic inequality in this country. Has anyone done that here?
I don't know if that's exactly the kind of question we need at this particular forum, but I hear what you're saying, and it is a factor in homelessness.
And
joblessness is definitely a factor in homelessness.
Yeah, and
we're not going to solve that particular issue right here.
And I'll just say one thing really briefly about that. First of all, I can't agree more with the two points you raise: inequity and climate change. I think that's right. Mm-hmm. And to that end, here in you may not know this, but here in San Jose, we were one of the first cities in the whole country to raise the minimum wage, in part because, irrespective of what the emerging jobs are, we have got to make sure that there's a livable wage irrespective of the job. And that's not an offshore anything. That is a quit being so cheap here, you know, thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There's that. And then the second thing I would just say is that San Jose, many people don't know this, but we are one of the, we have one of the highest percentage of maintaining manufacturing in this area. And so the point you raise, if you're right about talking about ground zero, like if there's an opportunity to expand manufacturing, you're absolutely right. This is a place to do it, in particular because we have so many new companies coming that are needing manufacturing is a core component of R&D. So you're right, and I think the city of San Jose has taken a lot. I'm not there anymore. I used to be, but I'm very proud of the work the city's doing, but we can do so much more.
It's jobs. The jobs is a huge part of this.
And pay people.
Yes. Sir, a question?
Actually, I have a question followed by an observation followed by a question, but I now have two because you actually brought up something very important. You're talking about, I can't remember the phrase you used, but I've been president of my neighborhood association for the last 10 years. And for 3 years ago, I was homeless because a new owner of my building decided to kick me out so he could jack up the rents. Mm-hmm. Took me 5 months to find another place, and I was lucky to find it in the same neighborhood. But we have a homeless encampment in my neighborhood. And I was on next door for our neighborhood. I was, in fact, one of the people that started it as the president. And when all the NIMBYs, they were trying to get that encampment booted. But I've talked to all these people. Every one of them, this was where they lived prior to becoming homeless. This is why they were in our neighborhood. Right. They're not coming out from somewhere else like Sam had talked about earlier. They're here because that's where they call home. Mm-hmm. And I started vocally advocating for them, as you suggested, you know, trying to say, look, they're our neighbors. Why don't we include them? Why don't we treat them as neighbors rather than as shunning them? I ended up getting booted off of next door.
Mm. Oh, booted off it.
They locked me out and canceled my account because I was being too vocally advocating against what everybody else was, and they complained about
you
me to the higher ups.
So, are you in San Jose?
I am in San Jose, District 1, Stevens Creek Neighborhood Association. But what you said earlier, it's got to start at the top. The leaders of Nextdoor should be reading the conversations. I'm not just bashing. I'm trying to advocate, right?
Well, let me divine a question from what you're saying.
Okay.
Because this is really supposed to be about questions.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I think what Jen, talk about how to overcome that kind of resistance. Of NIMBYism, because that's a huge subject.
Jen's like, wow.
It's stopping a lot of what's going on with the tiny home projects.
Actually, the answer is that the elected officials still have to do the right thing.
Exactly.
And it's hard when...
They need to step up.
Cindy, no. It's hard when 9,000 people are yelling at them about something bad and 10 people are saying, go! We need to help. To me, I think about it as the wind in the sails, right? We need, at any of these given Tuesdays, 6 votes or 5 votes or 3 votes to make major decisions for people's lives, right? And so if the only people are the everybody else on your next door listserv, right, except for you, yelling at her, it makes it really hard.
And it's a difficult decision because you have people who own property. And they're afraid that their property values are going to go down. They're afraid people are going to have to rip off stuff to support things.
We have to stop coddling that kind of behavior.
Well, Cindy,
that is racist.
Well,
how do you respond when that comes up?
Let me make one point. So I don't know how many of you know the assessor here in our county. His name's Larry Stone. Good, you booed. Those of you who know him. The assessor, he loves to be booed, so you didn't even hurt his feelings in absentia.
Good for him.
But here's the thing. What Larry does is he goes out and he explains to people that their property values do in fact not go down when we build affordable housing near
them. Thank you.
And so we have that is a very factual thing that we can share. And I would just say to all of you, one, if you're moving a project in a community and you need an advocate who will wear wild colored clothing, you know, as we get older, we just get a little wild. Woo! But wild colored clothing, and he has facts. He will demonstrate this fact. And I think the other thing is that while facts don't always matter, clearly, in this country, while facts don't always matter, what we can't seed is continuing to put those out there, because that's how you change hearts and minds, is helping them see that what they believe actually matches. And I think it's easy to make that other argument.
It's the kind of argument we have going on with navigation centers, which are meant to quickly move people into housing. Actually, crime and trouble goes down when you have a fully serviced navigation center in a neighborhood. Most people wouldn't expect that or know that. Mm-hmm. But it's about information. It's about reading your newspaper, so you read more things. There's another question right over there. Can we get the microphone over there, please?
Sorry, I actually had the mic to ask a question.
Only so much time. We only got about 3 minutes left here. I'm sorry.
And I apologize in advance. This is a little orthogonal, but a lot of my friends and neighbors all want this.
Oh, here's a lady back here. Okay.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Two mics. All right. Start over again.
A lot of my friends and neighbors, they all want single-family homes and yards, and we are in denial about how population density has increased, and most people are unwilling to move into apartments to densify. Mm-hmm. Could we harness self-interest and do things like, well, okay, the VTA is not working very well, and couldn't we harness something where we could leverage revitalizing the transit and the transit corridors so that we could have housing, subways, and freeways all combined in these spaces that are open today that are just freeways? Couldn't we actually leverage something like that?
It's been going on for years all over the region. Yeah.
So what do we do? How do we make it happen?
So to be totally brutally honest about this, we need you to come out and say what you just said at public meetings. Mm-hmm. Because the reality is that we are asking people who are just, they're your community members. Like I see one of our lovely Smarticle council members from Milpitas here, and I'm just so glad you're here. But part of what happens is that when you're not there and we're having a discussion about land use and intensification, there are 100 other people saying, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, you're going to ruin my neighborhood. Yeah. And so we got to get out there and we got to have conversations. The second thing I would just say very briefly is that we are, in this region, we are building much more densely than we have before, particularly along these corridors. I will emphasize that when those projects come before councils, that the first thing that we're asked to do is lower the density. So if we believe that there are lots of ways that people can live, they can live in single-family housing, and we have a lot of emerging, especially the young folks, they don't really want a yard. They want a dog, and they don't want a car, and anyway, I think we could build lots of kinds of housing. But it really comes down to creating the political space and will for people to be bold, and then the opportunity to change hearts and minds. And you will help us do that. Mm-hmm.
And that is not just in this county. This is all over the state. That's an ongoing conversation. Now the lady over here, please.
Yes. Hi. First of all, I wanted to say hi to my old boss, Cindy.
Hello.
I started out this morning crying because of what happened in Mississippi. Yeah. And I guess I'm going to go to bed crying tonight because of this conversation. So I'm going to take this to a real even level here. One of the things I know for sure is when you go into the city websites to look for housing in the housing developments that are already open, they've been open for a lot of years, it is very difficult to get information about what's available. It's a very static website. So I'm wondering if in the efforts that you've made in the last couple of years that has changed or improved. Like, in other words, if I want to go and say, where is an apartment open? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I would just say, Catherine from the Housing Authority was just saying we're working on it. I think that the point that you raised, Rosie, that is so critical is this. We have got to be so much more transparent about what's available and what's not. Because we're dealing with what people believe and think versus what we can show them. And so we're going to get there, but it's all got to be transparent. I think that's 100% right. And by the way, across the board, whether we're talking about foster care or CalFresh, any of that, as transparent as we can be in terms of what's available, making it easy for people to access, and making it easy and demonstrating that we respect people's time by making it easy for them to access in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're 100% right.
Okay, we're just about out of time. I have to ask each one of our panelists to give a quick elevator pitch on what can people do to help? It comes off top of your head.
I feel like I've already
go this way.
We already
Cindy
answered
first,
that.
And then
I'm
Jen last. That's right.
Answers.
I know you got a bunch of ideas.
So number one, I think very simple, and everybody can do it, is be kind. right? So kindness is like, and I've told Jen earlier this week, kindness is like, I'm not just saying good morning, but making coffee for somebody, right? So on the street, you know, it's looking them in the eye and saying, hi. If there's a bottle of water in your hand, it doesn't have to be money. It's acknowledging their existence. Mm-hmm. So be kind. And I heard the mayor earlier say, compassionate and respectful. Do you want to receive compassion from other people? Do you want to receive respect from other people? I tell you what, people that are on the street, it's the same for them because they are human just like you are human, right? Number two, volunteer, right? So there is homeless shelters all throughout the Bay Area. Pick one that it appeals to you. Show up, pick up something, a water and a cup, put it in there and serve it up to someone. And as you're serving it, look them in the eye and say, hello, how are you doing? They might engage with you, they might not, but you have done your part and you can go home and sleep at night and not cry because you know that you have done made a difference. It's however small that difference might be.
That is absolutely right. Cindy, what do you think?
I say be loud, be proud. And be a visionary. You know, use your voice on behalf of others, and it will change the world.
Yeah. Jen?
Say yes to housing where you live and support the elected officials that are trying to make that happen.